HPPodCraft.com.
All this last week, you must know, him or it, whatever it is that lives in that cabinet, has been crying night and day for some sort of medicine and cannot get it to his mind. It was sometimes his way, the master's that is, to write his orders on a sheet of paper and throw it on the stair. We've had nothing else this week back, nothing but papers and a closed door and the very meals left there to be smuggled in when nobody was looking. Well, sir, every day, aye, and twice and thrice in the same day, there have been orders and complaints, and I have been sent flying to all the wholesale chemists in town. Every time I brought the stuff back, there would be another paper telling me to return it because it was not pure, and another order to a different firm. This drug is wanted bitter bad, sir, whatever for.
Yeah, gotta have his pops.
For God's sake, please deliver with haste.
That excerpt we heard from the top was from the chapter The Last Night, the eighth chapter in The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde by Robert Louis Stevenson. I always thought that it was odd that people in marketing a product will make it seem so good as to be addictive. Yeah. Like that's a good thing. You know, like the Sugar Pops commercials or even people claiming to be a chocoholic.
Sure.
There's this strange dance with addiction that is done in pop culture that I find kind of unsettling.
I throw my empty Sugar Pops boxes away down the street so the neighbors don't know how much I'm eating. Yay! Buy some Sugar Pops!
Those commercials, I mean, do you remember the kids was doing like really weird, malicious things just to get his Sugar Pops?
I like to eat some Sugar Pops in my room before I come out to the table to eat Sugar Pops. Just in case there aren't enough Sugar Pops.
Gotta have my pops.
Then I carefully watch everybody else and try to eat as much as them because I don't know what's normal. Who was that reader?
Oh, our reader is none other than Matt Young, frontman and all-around kick-ass guy from the band Hex.
Yes.
Gotta check out their sweet stuff at hextheband.com, and that is H-E-K-Z, and pre-order their new album, Invicta. You will not be disappointed.
That's right. You know how sometimes people will say, hey, I'm not angry, I'm just disappointed. Well, with Invicta, it's the opposite. You won't be disappointed, you'll be angry. Angry that it's not on all the time. Yeah! Okay, here's where we are in The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde so far.
Yeah.
This lawyer, Utterson, represents an old friend, Dr. Jekyll. Jekyll has lately developed a relationship with the mysterious child-trampling scoundrel called Mr. Hyde, and has made Hyde the beneficiary of his will should he die or disappear under strange circumstances. But after Mr. Hyde beats a member of Parliament to death with a stick, he himself disappears, and it seems like Jekyll is free of the mysterious man's influence. For a while, he's fun at parties again, but lately he's become reclusive and has asked Utterson to leave him alone and let him go his own dark way. And that gets us to The Last Night.
You know, I like how we play this little game where we give a synopsis as if the person listening to this podcast has not listened to the episode before. Has that ever happened in the history of podcasting? No.
It is the most dangerous game.
This chapter starts with Poole, Jekyll's butler. I don't know about this Jekyll business. It still feels wrong to me. It's like wearing a pair of underpants that are just one size too small. It doesn't feel right.
You know, one time, like maybe 15 years ago, all of my underwear was dirty and I didn't want to do laundry. So I ran down to the Ross Dress for Less on the corner and I bought a new 3-pack of underwear. But I didn't feel like shopping either, so I did it pretty fast. And when I got home, I opened the package and I realized they were like triple XL. Like each pair of underwear was a hammock. But I was still too lazy to like take them back. So I just fashioned like a little underwear belt. And actually, I wore them. I wore all three of them over the week. When I remember it, I didn't know at the time how to articulate how it felt while I was wearing that underwear. But now I have the words. It feels like saying Dr. Jekyll.
I felt like that maybe by forcing myself to do it the right way for a whole episode would help.
Yeah.
But honestly, it has not. So as wrong as it is, I'm going to go back to Jekyll.
It's not wrong. As far as you know, that's the way he pronounces it. It just happened when they came into England. It's totally fine.
Sure. Poole, Jekyll's butler, has come to Utterson for help. He tells Utterson that Jekyll has been locking himself up in a cabinet, which I thought was like literally a wardrobe.
Oh, good. But
until I kept reading it, and then I'm like, wait a minute, this doesn't mean what I think it means.
Right, because nobody uses the word that way, and they're talking about a small room or study that Jekyll keeps, but...
I went through this whole chapter pretty much until the very end before I was like, oh, wait a minute, this is different.
Yeah, and as a kid reading this, I really have a memory of that. Like, I'd never heard anybody use the word cabinet in reference to a room before. I'd only heard of filing cabinet, kitchen cabinet. So even though I did figure it out by the context, I have a strong memory of imagining Hyde all squeezed up in this little cabinet.
Yeah.
It's just a visual I couldn't get out of my head.
So he's in this room, all locked up. It's freaking Poole out, and he's not sure how to handle it. Poole tells Utterson that he thinks that there has been foul play. When asked to explain, Poole just tells him, look, why don't you come to Dr. Jekyll's and just see what's going on? And Utterson just grabs his coat. He's ready to go because he's been dying to go in there anyway.
Yeah.
This is just an excuse for him to go check out what's happening. So it's cold and windy that night, giving Utterson the feeling of coming disaster. Again, I think it's his sense of the supernatural. Mm. They knock on the door to Jekyll's house. And one of the fearful servants lets them in. They're all like kind of cowering in the hall. And they're all pretty freaked out by what's going on.
Servants are always freaking out. I'm so sick of it. Servants, if there are any listening to the show, please calm down. It's not always about you. Sure, we have a few servant listeners.
Sure.
Calm down.
Poole tells Utterson that they're going to approach Jekyll's cabinet door. And he wants him to hear but not be heard. So they quietly approach.
And as, you know, they cross through that empty surgical theater, I don't know if we mentioned it before in the earlier episodes, but that laboratory portion of Jekyll's property is an old surgical laboratory. Yeah. It's a really unique setting, you know, and he's just occupying the room behind it, which probably was the lecturer's office or maybe the building manager's office. Do you think there's significance, though, to Jekyll owning this old theater, or is it just for the atmosphere of it?
Atmosphere, because what Jekyll's doing is a chemical experiment. I don't think surgery is involved in any of this. So it's just something that's held over from the time before. But thinking about people being operated on and maybe people dying in there, it definitely creates an atmosphere.
And also, it's a haunting feeling, this big open space, and you know what has gone on there, but now there's nobody there at all. And it's sort of that should be the main room, but it's the antechamber to Jekyll's experimental laboratory.
Yeah.
There's something about that there might be more meaning to it, but I do think it provides a really excellent, almost gothic kind of atmosphere.
Oh, yeah. It's very cool. So Poole knocks on the door and says through the door that Utterson is there for a visit. And a voice from inside shouts, I can't see anyone. And Poole says, thank you, sir. And then he walks back to the main hall with Utterson. And then Poole says, did that sound like my master's voice?
And Utterson says it seemed much changed.
Yeah. Poole thinks that it wasn't Jekyll at all, but he thinks that he has been killed and replaced by someone else. This is a very strange tale, Poole. This is rather a wild tale, my man. Said Utterson.
Wild tale, my man. I thought that was a weird line. If Poole had said, I think he's drinking a shake that makes him into another guy, that would be a wild tale.
Yeah.
But like Hyde killing Jekyll, that's not really too wild of a tale. He's already murdered somebody.
Yeah.
Somebody very important. And he's the beneficiary of Jekyll's will, which is his motive. Plus, he's currently at large and he has access to the space. So it's not really that wild of a tale.
Not at all. So Poole starts talking, as that quote in the opening said, for the last 8 days, Dr. Jekyll has been in his lab and he's ordered his meals in, sending Poole to find drugs that he's failing to find in London.
What he's getting from the chemist is not pure enough.
Utterson asks for the papers that Jekyll was sending out to the chemist. Mm-hmm. Poole produces this note. It says, Dr. Jekyll presents his compliments to the chemist. He assures them that their last sample is impure and quite useless for his present purpose. Some time ago, Dr. J purchased a somewhat large quantity from the chemist. He now begs them to search with the most sedulous care, and should any of the same quality be left, forward it to him at once. Expense is no consideration. The importance of this to Dr. J can hardly be exaggerated. For God's sake, find me some of the old. This note is in the handwriting of Dr. Jekyll, so he wrote it, for sure. But Poole says, who cares about the handwriting? I have seen this guy. He came out when he was looking for something. And when I saw him, it was definitely somebody else. Someone whose mere presence terrified me.
Poole says, he looked up when I came in, gave a kind of cry, and whipped upstairs into the cabinet. It was but for 1 minute that I saw him, but the hair stood upon my head like quills. Sir, if that was my master, why had he a mask upon his face? If it was my master, why did he cry out like a rat and run from me?
Utterson says that, well, maybe he's sick. Maybe he's got some disease that has messed him up so bad that he looks different and that it's affected his voice.
You know, Utterson's probably thinking he's got syphilis or something like that that would actually cause these things.
Poole is like, my master is tall. This guy is like a dwarf. I know my master. This is not my master. You know, it is so weird to call people master. Like, could you imagine if you were working at some place and the guy goes, yeah, no, My name's Steve. Don't call me your boss, but call me your master. Because they're just employees. They call him master. It doesn't sit with me.
Would you like it if somebody called you master?
Utterson says, look, the stuff you're telling me means I have to act. And the pool's like, thank God, yes. Because he's a servant. So he can't do anything drastic. But Utterson is his friend and he's a...
Typically what a master would think about a servant. I suggest it and you're already playing the role.
So Poole gets an axe and Utterson gets a fire poker and they're ready to break in. But before they do, Utterson asks, was this man Hyde? And Poole says, yeah, I think it probably was Hyde.
Yeah.
Again, I didn't get a good look, but he felt unnatural just like Hyde did. There was something queer about that gentleman, something that gave a man a turn. I don't know rightly how to say it, sir, beyond this, that you felt it in your marrow, kind of cold and thin. And Utterson just kind of goes, yep, I know what he's talking about. So Utterson sends Bradshaw, the footman, to the back door, the one from the beginning of the story, you know, that back door that they walked by and saw Hyde going in.
Yeah.
So there's going to be no escaping for whoever's inside. At the door, they hear walking around inside, but it sounds lighter footed than Hyde, because Hyde kind of clomped around, I guess. Utterson asks if he heard anyone or anything else in there. And Poole says he thought he might have heard a woman softly crying.
Or a person weeping like a woman.
Yes.
Or a lost soul. It says, I came away with that upon my heart that I could have wept too.
Yeah.
Nice. Poor Jekyll. No matter what his intentions, I do feel bad that he screwed himself up so much. He's just in there lamenting what he's done to him.
Yeah. I just watched that 1932 version of the movie that you were talking about earlier.
Oh, yeah. You finally got to see
it. Yeah, it's really good and very disturbing, like you were saying. Mm-hmm. I really recommend people check it out. One of the things that's in there is they have Jekyll engaged to be married, which kind of ups the stakes, I think, of the whole thing.
Yeah.
So he's got this whole relationship that he's cultivating and he's trying to get in good with her father, who's, you know, very traditional. And so when he starts doing his debauched stuff, it almost makes a little more sense in a way because he's trying to fit into this very proper upper crust society and he feels oppressed.
Yeah.
He wants to break out and do the things, have like, I guess, dirty sex with people, but also be violent and be cruel and be mean and not be polite. And then there's that prostitute that Hyde sort of dominates. And it's not just because when you talked about it, I thought he locked her into a room or something, but it's not that at all.
No.
It's a relationship. And it's just this...
Yeah, that's why I said it was like a Weinstein thing, because it's more of a psychologically manipulative...
I mean, he beats her, too.
And also, it's the prostitute that Jekyll had previously helped.
Right.
So it was like when he met her and she came on to him, he didn't indulge it then, but as Hyde, he does in such a violent way. And I think that actually does tie up with the notion of hypocrisy in the book, how the repression of some of these things ends up making folks do them in a really awful...
An awful extreme.
Tie them up with more negative impulses.
Exactly. The stakes, I thought, in the film were much higher personally for Jekyll because he's the protagonist of the story, sort of. Because, you know, Utterson's in there briefly, but he's not really one of the main characters. So it's about him and the sound of somebody crying and feeling sick. I really felt bad for him by the end of the movie, for Jekyll.
There's also that crazy scene at the McDonald's where they all dance.
Yeah, wait a minute.
The Hyde shuffle, where he climbs up on the counter and then everybody knows the choreography suddenly.
Are you thinking of Mac and Me?
Oh, I'm sorry. That's right.
Jekyll and Hyde, Mac and Me, easy mistake.
So easy.
Easy mistake.
Both about man's duality.
Utterson knocks on the door and says, Jekyll, I demand to see you. And if you don't open that door, I'm coming in. And the voice says, have mercy. But it's Hyde's voice. So Poole starts to axe the door like a baller, man. It's freaking hardcore. He's just on it. And inside they hear shrieking. They finally keep banging on the door till it falls down and then the room inside is just totally quiet.
Right in the middle, there lay the body of a man, sorely contorted and still twitching. They drew near on tiptoe, turned it on its back, and beheld the face of Edward Hyde. He was dressed in clothes far too large for him. Clothes of the doctor's bigness. The cords of his face still moved with a semblance of life, but life was quite gone, and by the crushed file in the hand and the strong smell of kernels that hung upon the air, Utterson knew that he was looking on the body of a self-destroyer.
So it seems Hyde has killed himself by drinking some kind of poison. His clothes are too large, and they seem to be Jekyll's.
His underwear is much too large, but it seems he's fashioned a sort of crude underwear belt. So that's what all this lab equipment was for. My God, he was a genius.
They search the whole house but can't find Jekyll anywhere, alive or dead.
They think maybe he could be buried under the floor.
Mm.
The door to the outside is locked. It says, lying nearby on the flags, they found the key already stained with rust.
Yeah.
Poole says, do you not see, sir, it is broken, much as if a man had stamped on it. That was Hyde's key that he had earlier.
When looking around, they find a large mirror, which is kind of strange that such a thing would be in a lab, Utterson remarks.
The lab is also kind of comfy. It's a weird look into Mr. Hyde's last days. There's the fireside, where the easy chair was drawn cozily up, and the tea things stood ready to the sitter's elbow, the very sugar in the cup. And it's very incongruous to imagine Mr. Hyde, this monster, you know, sipping tea by the fire.
Yeah.
There's also a book lying open near the tea. Utterson was amazed to find it a copy of a pious work for which Jekyll had several times expressed great esteem, annotated, in his own hand with startling blasphemies.
Oh, wow.
So this scene kind of reeks of the demonic possession genre as well. You know, it's like Jekyll's trying to read the religious work while Hyde blasphemes and mocks him, all happening, you know, internally. And it seems like just with this setting that the men have discovered, Stevenson is showing that some sort of war happened here that we were not privy to.
Right.
The two personalities were at odds with one another.
On the desk, they find an envelope marked for Utterson. In it, there is a will, like the one before, but with Utterson as the beneficiary, not Hyde. He sees the date on the note and realizes that Jekyll was there that day. There's no way that Hyde could have ditched a body just that quickly, so Jekyll must be alive somewhere. A note on the envelope reads, "My dear Utterson, when this shall fall into your hands, I have disappeared. Under what circumstances, I have not the penetration to foresee, but my instinct and all the circumstances of my nameless situation tell me that the end is sure and must be early. Go then, and first read the narrative which Lanyon warned me he was to place in your hands, and if you care to hear more, turn to the confession of your unworthy and unhappy friend, Henry Jekyll."
It's crazy that Jekyll is acting as a sort of editor of his own story here. You know, he's telling Utterson the correct order to read the documents for maximum dramatic impact. If you want to avoid spoilers, you have to do it this way. If you do it the other way, you're going to know what happened.
So Utterson tells Poole to keep mum on this whole packet and what has gone on, since they aren't sure Jekyll is even dead.
He tells the servants, "It is now 10. I must go home and read these documents in quiet, but I shall be back before midnight when we shall send for the police." So he wants them to just leave the body in there while he figures things out. And this is, in the book, the last we hear of Utterson. He exits the story entirely.
Oh, right, yeah.
Everything after this is prequel.
Yeah.
So we don't know if he came back at midnight, if he told the police anything.
Right.
You know, does he show the documents to them and spill it all about this transformation? Or does he cover it up and tell people that Jekyll is still at large, that this is a suicide of a stranger?
Yeah.
You know, or maybe he gets in trouble because the will was so recently changed.
Right.
And Jekyll is suddenly missing.
Right.
Is Utterson implicated?
Could be.
I would guess that he would go back, collect all of Jekyll's research, call the police, but not tell them the truth.
Yeah.
Keep the research and then call in another doctor to consult on what he's found, a doctor of very high esteem.
Okay.
And they redevelop the formula, and boom, you've got the sequel to this, the sexy case of Dr. Sex and Mr. Sexy.
Oh, God.
No?
Yeah, that's brilliant. I'm writing that down.
Thanks, but that's all the future of the narrative. Now, it's all prequel, as I said. We must go back and read the secret testimonies of the miserable souls who survived this terrifying ordeal.
Yes, now we're going to read Dr. Lanyon's narrative.
Dr. Lanyon recounts how he received a letter from Jekyll back in January, a registered letter, meaning that proof of receipt would go back to Jekyll once it was delivered. And this is odd because he and Lanyon are friends. They just had dinner the night before. They don't write letters to each other. They just get together and talk if they have something to say. So he doesn't know why he'd be getting a letter.
He opens the letter from Jekyll and it says, "Hey, I want you to come over to my place and break into the upper room in my lab. Poole will help you out."
It's not exactly flippant, though. It's like, "Lanyon, my life, my honor, my reason are all at your mercy. If you fail me tonight, I am lost." So this is serious stuff. He says, "Drive straight to my house. Poole will be waiting with a locksmith.
Right.
The door of my cabinet is then to be forced."
Jekyll wants Lanyon to take a specific drawer from the lab and everything in it, carry it back to his home, and wait until late at night when the servants are all in bed. Then this guy will come at midnight and take the drawer.
"A man who will present himself in my name." And he says, "Don't ask questions now, but 5 minutes after this is all done, if you insist on an explanation, you'll get one."
Can you imagine asking someone to do something like this? Like, I kind of wish one of my friends would, because it would be really exciting. Like, okay,
I want you to break into your friend's apartments. I know how you are. How come nobody ever asked me to break into their apartment?
Well, you know, so and like, and then have a secret rendezvous with somebody. I mean,
I hear
you. If I knew more drug dealers, I bet you these things would happen all the time, but I don't know any drug dealers, so.
You gotta get to know some more drug dealers. Yeah.
This reminds me also of the time that Christian and I got dressed up in disguise when you first arrived in Los Angeles. I don't know if you remember this.
Yeah.
This was before 9/11.
Of course I remember it. I had just moved here. That was my first day arriving at the airport. You had me dress up in disguise.
Well, Christian and I put on suits and sunglasses. This was before 9/11, so you can just breeze around in the airport, no problem. And they had lockers and everything there. We were in disguise, you know, like spy disguise.
Yeah.
And then we dropped you a note, and then the note said, go to this locker and then open it up, and there's a disguise because there's people coming after you.
Yeah.
And we got to get you out of the airport safely. And you did it. You put on this crazy, crazy disguise.
I did.
And we got you out of the airport safe and sound. So it all worked.
I did everything as instructed.
You had that. You had that experience.
But it was poor timing for it. I really appreciated that you guys did that. It's kind of like when people will say, I don't like writing. It's very difficult. But I like having written.
Yeah.
Like, I liked having that experience. But at the time, I had just like moved thousands of miles away from home and left my family behind and was totally making a huge life change. So I was kind of like, what's going on?
This is what you signed up for, that nuttiness.
It was good stuff in my memory.
So Lanya thinks that Jekyll is off of his nut, but he feels honor bound to do as he asks. So he goes and does just what he was told to do.
He goes to Jekyll's place, he grabs the drawer, and he goes home.
Of course, he does a bit of peeping in the drawer, and he finds that there are several vials, one with salt and another with some red liquid. It has a notebook with years' worth of notes in there, things that say double and total failure, but the notes don't paint any picture of what it was that he was actually doing. Since he thinks Jekyll might be totally nuts, he arms himself with a revolver.
Good thinking.
So at midnight, there's a knock at the door, and a little man in clothes that don't fit, Hyde, obviously, is there.
This person, who had thus from the first moment of his entrance struck in me what I can only describe as a disgustful curiosity, was dressed in a fashion that would have made an ordinary person laughable. His clothes, that is to say, although they were of a rich and sober fabric, were enormously too large for him in every measurement. The trousers hanging on his legs and rolled up to keep them from the ground, the waist of the coat below his haunches, and the collar sprawling wide upon his shoulders. Strange to relate, this ludicrous accoutrement was far from moving me to laughter. Rather, as there was something abnormal and misbegotten in the very essence of the creature that now faced me, something seizing, surprising, and revolting, this fresh disparity seemed but to fit in with and to reinforce it, so that to my interest in the man's nature and character, there was added a curiosity as to his origin, his life, his fortune, and status in the world.
This is a lot like me with my large underwear. You know, it seems funny in the recounting, but if you were to see it, there was something abnormal and misbegotten about
sure.
it, something surprising and revolting.
Hyde is impatient and just wants the drawer. Lanyon lets him in and he points to the drawer. It's just sitting on the floor. Hyde gets super excited. Hyde asks for a glass. Though dubious, Lanyon gets him one. Hyde takes the contents of the vials and mixes them.
The mixture, which at first was of a reddish hue, began, in proportion as the crystals melted, to brighten in color, to effervesce audibly, to throw off small fumes of vapor. Suddenly, and at the same moment, the ebullition ceased, and the compound changed to a dark purple, which faded again more slowly to a watery green. All of these changes in the liquid, I think, are the first thing about the story that captured my imagination, this process of mixing a potion.
Oh my god, yeah.
As I was reading this, I realized that my knowledge of this novel actually might predate my memory.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I must have seen a movie on TV, or maybe it was filtered through Sesame Street or something, but one of my earliest memories is being in the kitchen with two glasses and pouring water or Kool-Aid back and forth between the two, like mixing up a secret formula, and then drinking it, falling to the ground and coming back up a scary monster. Like, I knew to do this.
Yeah.
The thing I was emulating, I don't remember. Like, it's lost to the time before my brain was making memories. My first encounter with this story,
dude,
which is kind of crazy.
I would always mix up so many different things. Nothing dangerous.
Yeah.
I would mix up all the different spices that we had.
Oh, of course. Sure.
I tried every concoction, every mixture to hopefully transform into some kind of creature.
little milk with some fruit cocktail. Ah, didn't like drinking that one.
No, they were terrible.
Might make me more monstrous, though.
Yeah, I thought maybe the worse it tasted, the more of a monster you would turn into. But alas.
That only makes sense.
The only monster I ever turned into was man. So Hyde says...
The worst of them all.
Hyde says, should I take this glass with me or drink this here? Because if I drink it here, you're going to see some shit that will freak you out. He says, your sight shall be blasted by a prodigy to stagger the unbelief of Satan.
Wow.
Lanyon is like, sure, yeah, whatever, nutcase. Hyde says, remember your promise to keep it mum.
And if you as a reader are still not sure what's going on, there's a clue before the transformation in that promise when he says, remember your vows. What follows is under the seal of our profession. So this weird guy's a doctor?
He put the glass to his lips and drank at one gulp. A cry followed. He reeled, staggered, clutched at the table and held on, staring with injected eyes, gasping with open mouth. And as I looked, there came, I thought, a change. He seemed to swell. His face became suddenly black and the features seemed to melt and alter. And the next moment, I'd sprung to my feet and leaped back against the wall, my arms raised to shield me from that prodigy, my mind submerged in terror. Oh God, I screamed, and oh God, again and again. For there before my eyes, pale and shaken and half fainting, and groping before him with his hands like a man restored from death, there stood Henry Jekyll.
Jekyll explains what is going on to Lanyon over the next hour, but it freaked him out so bad that he can't sleep.
Well, he's so shaken by what he saw that he eventually died from it. So, you know, it was that mind-blowing. And I like that we discover at the end of this chapter that Lanyon's first name was Hasty. Like, you know, he was hasty. He died even before Jekyll died. That's how hasty he was.
He later found out that the name of Dr. Jekyll's alter ego was Hyde, which we all figured out already because this book has been spoiled by pop culture. Still... a great read.
Of course.
That ends the chapter and episode.
Yeah, we should probably tie it up here.
We know that Jekyll and Hyde are one and the same, but we still don't know why and how. That we'll get in the next episode.
I'm glad you said it that way, too, because I think that applies to the spoiler thing. It definitely would have been cool to be able to read this and not have had it spoiled by pop culture, as you say.
Yeah.
But even then, as you were reading it, you probably would have figured out early in the book what was happening.
Yeah.
That's something I don't know if we've talked about too much. Maybe we have, but it's highly relevant to the material we cover on the show because, you know, surprise is a really fun part of reading a story or seeing a movie. When you discover something in the plot, suddenly everything you thought is challenged. Nothing is as it seems. I think we crave the feeling that that gives us. It really sucks when somebody tells you beforehand what's going to happen and ruins your chance to have that specific feeling.
Yeah.
That said, if revealing one or two facts about a movie's plot or book spoils it, as in then it's no longer fun to watch, then that movie or book already sucks. Like, there needs to be more to it than just a surprise.
Sure.
And that's why a whodunit, if it's good, is actually more like what you said, which is a why done it.
Yeah.
You know, the really juicy part are what are the motives and backstory that led to this surprise.
Exactly.
So, like, if you see Empire Strikes Back in 1980, that revelation socks you in the gut when you find out Vader is Luke's father.
Oh, dude.
It's a shock. You were, if you were born after that movie came out, your whole life you've heard people misquoting it and saying, Luke, I am your father.
Right.
So you know the revelation, but the movie's still great.
Yeah.
It's not spoiled for you because you still want to know how did this happen.
Yeah.
And you go through the characters. You know, Luke still doesn't know when you watch the movie, so it still grabs you.
Yeah.
And this goes for Lovecraft stories. When we were reading those, we would always joke about how obvious the italicized ending was way back, like two paragraphs into the whole thing.
Yeah.
But if it's a good story, the thing that brings you back time and time again are the crazy concepts behind the revelation.
Exactly.
You know, why is this thing happening?
Yeah. And also, it is about the journey getting to the end of the story. It's not the twist. It's not the surprise.
No.
It's the mood and the atmosphere and the way that things happen. It's really interesting. I mean, I knew the basics of the story before we started reading it, but it was very different than what I thought it was going to be. The structure of it was different. The way the story has played out. The focus on Utterson as the protagonist of the story, really. It was very different and refreshing and interesting and actually a little modern in a way that I didn't anticipate it being.
And I think that when we get into the next episode, which is told entirely from the point of view of Jekyll, we'll get into that why of Jekyll's research. And I think that the reason this book is still as famous today as it ever was is because of that why.
Yeah.
It's still an interesting question. Because we knew about mixing the formula. We know that the guy turns into another guy. You know all these things just from pop culture. But really, did you know why he would do this to himself? Why he would create the formula? Why he would be interested in separating these two beings?
No. I want to thank Matt Young for Reading Like a Champ. Go check out Hex and be on the lookout for their new album, Invicta, coming out in April.
You can pre-order it now, so go check it out. Invicta by Hex. We will be back next week with the conclusion of Dr. Jekyll/Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. I am Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lackey, and you have been listening to the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
HPPodcraft.com.
HPPodcraft.com.